distinguished speakers and delegates, and our mayors who are here today. I would like for our mayors to stand up so that we can see who you are, since this is a celebration of mayors. So Mayor Jerry Brown we have here. And Mayor Jamie Lerner from Curitiba, three-time former mayor. That counts. And I believe we have our distinguished mayor from Mill Valley. There we go. Thank you. Well, legislators say that in our visits to Sacramento, that health and environment doesn't resonate with the American public. They say that jobs and security are what people care about. Well, we all know here that a healthy environment means more security, less dependence on foreign oil. A healthy environment means jobs. We have sustainable jobs in clean tech just waiting. And renewable resource development is definitely an area that is going to supply a lot of jobs in the future. A healthy environment is required for healthy kids, and we know that as moms and women and parents. A health and environment does resonate. It resonates with me because my family's health is my number one family value. A healthy environment requires visionary leadership, and that's why we have these distinguished speakers here today, because they have done things that nobody else has even thought of doing. We're here to learn and celebrate their leadership on this United Nations World Environment Day. I'm Annette Gellert. I'm co-founder of the WELL Network, the Women's Environmental Leadership League. Welcome on behalf of all our women members who have put this together. I thank them for their efforts today. We sat down the room the other day and we decided we all were businesswomen. We'd all come from business. And that we were all environmentalists. And many of us were mothers. So being a business person and being an environmentalist is not mutually exclusive. And we decided that what we wanted most was to deliver a livable future for our children. And I have all my three children are here today. And it was about 30 years ago, my husband and I moved to right across the bay to Belvedere and bought a house right on the water. And when the children were born, and then after they were toddlers, I used to take them underneath the house so they could play with the rocks, play in the water. And they loved to pick up the rocks and look underneath and see all the little black crabs roaming around. And then being children, they would take their hands and put it right in their mouth. And since I'd just been reading in the paper that you shouldn't eat the fish in the bay because it was laced with mercury, and there was some stuff they were painting on the boats over in Sausalito Harbor that was some of the most toxic stuff known to man to keep the barnacles off, and I would go riding around in the boat and see signs that said, don't swim here because the water's polluted, I thought, well, is this safe? Is that safe for my kids to put their hands in the water and put it in their mouth? I mean, what happens, you know, to them? So I decided that I would find out, because of course government must have some kind of program that looked out so that I could find this information. Well, I searched and I searched. I'm still searching. This is like 25 years later. And there is no comprehensive plan, I hate to say, for protecting our health as when it comes to San Francisco Bay. And there's not a comprehensive long-term plan for protecting the health here, our health here in California. But other nations, such as Holland, and other nations, and we're going to talk about Holland today, have some wonderful innovative ideas, and we're going to learn about those. So I want to introduce Peggy Lauer, who is our executive director at WELL Network, and she will introduce our speakers. Peggy had about a 10-year stint with the Resource Renewal Institute, where she became an expert on green planning, particularly in Holland. She will lead our panel today, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning. We're going to have a pretty tight schedule. We're starting a little bit late, and we want to have everyone have the time that they have and the questions as well. So I just want to go over a little bit about how the next couple of hours are going to go, hopefully. In your program, you have one order of speaker. We're going to divert from that this afternoon. So we are going to start with Bianca Otshoff, then to Jaime Lerner, Jerry Brown, and then Rachel Richman, and why will become evident. I'm going to introduce each one, and then after their remarks, and I will speak up, where they were talking for about 10 to 15 minutes would be optimum. I'm going to open the questioning to the audience, and then at the end, we'll have a general discussion for all the speakers. So you will have a chance to ask questions as we go along. Before I introduce Bianca, I would just want to give a very brief introduction to the Netherlands Green Plan, or the Netherlands National Environmental Policy Plan, which they devised in 1989. The reason that it was able to be done, a very comprehensive approach, and we'll talk more about that as we go along, was because by the 1980s, the pollution in that country was palpable in the water, the land, the air. This is a highly industrialized country and also very agricultural, and obviously had a low water table. Sort of the tipping point came when everyone could actually feel what was going on in their country. They understood it. And then I believe the tipping point, and there's probably many, but the one that was most newsworthy had to do with diseased and dying seals showing up on their shores, which created a major event. So basically what happened was, with all of these things going on, with their country in disarray, in a sense, without anyone really understanding what that was about, they put their best minds together and came up with basically a systems analysis of what they were going to do, dissecting all the complex problems, and crafted a strategic plan, what we call here a green plan. And with their National Institute of Public Health and Environmental Protection, they put together their first iteration of their NEP, the National Environmental Policy Plan. So they had the science to back them up, and most people accepted that, even some industry. They had their themes, defined geographic scale. They had their target groups. And the idea was to strengthen three legs of the stool: the industry, government, and the nonprofits working toward a 25-year plan. Industry was key. The government had, as they say, the best minds putting this together, but they knew that they needed industry. So they went to the Confederation of the Netherlands Industry and Employers, which is very nice that they have them all together. And within a very short time, with a lot of consternation, a lot of hard work, they began to really build the deep trust that is needed to have a green plan work. One thing that I want to point out, because I can talk about how nice it is and how they all work together and all of those nice things, but the facts were, in, I'd say maybe within 10 years, maybe 15 years, they were able to decouple something that we have yet to even begin to grasp, and that is that a healthy economic development requires environmental degradation, a certain level that we all right now sort of accept. Well, they prove that you don't have to accept that, and that's what we want to be talking about today. They had measurable success and some intangible benefits stemming from building trust. They've had shifts in priorities. Like the United States and other countries, environment has slipped on the list of most important things: security, jobs, crime, same issues. And yet, when you talk to some industry people in Holland, they are still moving forward with voluntary agreements and their targets, and they are the ones now saying to government, you can't pull back. So in a way, they have decoupled another idea, that if the public isn't railing away, that industry won't change or won't comply. So with that, I'd like to open up to Bianca. Since 1999, she's worked at the Dutch Ministry of Economic Affairs, first with the Directorate General on Energy Policy for Households and the Built Environment, and then with the Directorate General Enterprise and Innovation, where she is the Senior Energy Policy Advisor for Industry. She is the General Secretary for the Benchmarking Covenant, which I hope she'll talk about, and a project leader for the Energy Transition International. She is also speaking, I believe, is it tomorrow or the next day? On Saturday. There is a three-day conference, which we'll tell you more about. If you are interested in what the Dutch model is about, they're having a three-day conference about this over the next 3 days at the St. Francis Hotel. Bianca?
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind invitation to be here today and share some of the experiences that we had in the Netherlands.
Just a little closer.
Okay. I'll try to speak up a bit. Can everybody hear me now?
Louder?
Okay. I have a little bit of a cold because always when I come to the United States, I have to get used to the air conditioning. Because in the Netherlands, we don't have air conditioning. I guess we don't need it, but also because it's really not energy efficient. So maybe you should learn something from how we build our buildings with natural ventilation. I think that's the topic tomorrow on our conference. But I was asked to talk a little bit about the long-term agreements that we have and the Environmental Action Plan. We now have our fourth Environmental Action Plan. Each 4 years we write a new one because, like Peggy said, the priorities change. In the beginning, water was the main priority that we had. The dead seals on our shores were something that caused a lot of public attention, and the first priority in the first action plan was water, the cleaning of the water. And today, I think we've succeeded in that field because the waters in the Netherlands are really clean, the rivers are clean, the fish is back. It's not something that we've done alone. It's something we've done with all the industry, but also with other countries within Europe. Because as the Netherlands, we are the lowest country of the Europe, so we get all the rubbish of all the other countries in our rivers. So we have to cooperate, and that's something that I think is most important in the way that we do things in the Netherlands. We have to cooperate with everybody else to do things because we're really small and because we're so influenced by all the other countries and what they're doing. So I think it's only natural that also within our own country we have a tradition of cooperation. And in the beginning that was really difficult because you have to build trust. Because the industry, which is the main partner for these kind of agreements, used to look upon the government as someone who was saying you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that and you have to do it this way or you have to do it that way. And always it used to be issue management. So one day we wanted them to do this and the other day we wanted them to change something else. And then we sat together and we were saying, well, this is not the way we should do things. If we really want to make some changes, then we have to do some long-term planning. So industry can also take this into account when they're planning their investments, because they don't plan an investment for just 1 year. They're planning them for 10, 15, or 20 years. For instance, in our paper industry, we have some machines that are 50 to 100 years old and that are really capital intensive. So you can't just ask them, well, just put in a new machine next year. That's not something they can do easily. I think in basically we have, like all countries, three ways of doing things. We have financial incentives, we have legislation, and we have the voluntary agreements. And voluntary agreements are the first thing that we go to when working on a new issue. We have now voluntary agreements on, for instance, waste, on packaging, on several environmental issues, and on energy. My main topic is energy, so I will explain most about those because that's my main area of expertise. But if you have questions on the other ones, you are welcome to ask them. At this moment, we have two different kinds of agreements on energy with industry. We have what we call the benchmarking covenant with the big industries. Those are all the companies that use more than half a petajoule a year. And that it's about 200 companies in the Netherlands. For them, we developed this benchmarking covenant because they were saying, well, we're not local players, we're global players. So if you're asking us to improve, you have to put it into perspective of the international standards. So we ask of them to become top of the world in 2012 in energy efficiency. And each 4 years, they do a benchmark where they compare their own company with other companies all over the world to see how their energy efficiency is doing compared to the others. And if they're lagging behind, then they have to give us a plan for the next couple of years on how they're going to improve their energy efficiency. Then we have the long-term agreements on energy efficiency for the medium-sized enterprises that don't operate in an international field or have lower energy use. And for them, we have an agreement that runs also until 2012, but we set a target together with them. We look at what kind of processes do you have, what kind of technology improvements can we expect in the next couple of years, so what can we ask from you to do on energy efficiency? Well, most of them will have an average energy efficiency improvement of 2 to 3% a year, which is really high if you consider that the average energy efficiency improvement in the Netherlands is below 1% at this moment. It used to be a bit higher, but because of the economic situation of the last couple of years, it has gone down a lot because less investments are done, less production is done, and if your production level is lower, then your energy efficiency is also lower because you can't use your ovens, for instance, to full capacity. And I think when we started writing the fourth National Environmental Plan, we realized that there were some environmental issues that with the first three plans we didn't address good enough. There were some environmental issues that asked for a different kind of policy, that even with our long-term agreements we wouldn't solve these problems. And one of them is mobility, one of them is agriculture, one of them is energy, and one of them is biodiversity. And in fourth national plan, we said, well, we need a different kind of approach for these problems because they're such big problems with such far-reaching effects that we can't solve them with the way we're used to doing things. So we developed a new kind of process to address these problems, which we call transition. And I will talk more about this on Saturday. But I'll just give you the highlights of this approach. The basis of this approach is, again, cooperation with industry. I'm responsible myself for the energy transition, which has a focus until 2050, and we make concrete plans for 2020. What we're doing in the first phase is sit together with industry and say, well, if you just think out of the box, 2050 is far enough away, what would a sustainable world look like? And how would your company fit into this sustainable world? What kind of resources would you use? What kind of products would you make? How would the surroundings of your industry look like? What kind of people would be working there? And from those kind of visionary images, we started to go back to 2020 saying, well, if you want to reach those goals in 2050, what concrete goals could you set for 2020? Because that's a time set that industry can work with. They do their own scenario planning. It's always 10, 15 to 20 years ahead. 50 years is too much, but you need that long-term focus to get them to be creative, to think about sustainability. If you start 5 years ahead, they say, well, that's not possible because I have this machine and I have to use this machine for the next 10 years or my investment, I won't get repaid for my investment. So 2050 was necessary to open up the minds, and 2020 was necessary to get concrete goals to focus on, to agree on, that those are the things we want to work on. And the next step is making what we call transition path towards those goals? What are the kinds of technologies that you need? What are the kinds of institutional changes that you need? What are the kind of changes in legislation that you need? What are the changes within the EU policy that you might need? And step by step, we are starting to work on these issues that need to be changed. And it's not only a change within industry, but it's a change within society, within also within the government. We have to change our own ways and start to think in those longer terms and look differently at legislation and make more possible, think from the perspective of what can be done and not from the perspective of what can't be done. And that's a mind shift that is necessary. And we've been working on this now for, I think, 3 years. And you start to see the changes being made, also within society themselves and within, for instance, the NGOs or the environmental organizations that are now working together with us and working together with industry instead of opposing them, and starting to look at what can be done and what are the changes that should be made and how can we help each other in this long route to a sustainable future. I think the things that are most important and maybe the lessons I would like to share with you are that goal setting and a long-term perspective are very, very important if you want to reach anything. Because industry doesn't, it thinks in 3 month payback times, but if you want them to think in 10, 20 years, which is necessary if you really want to make some changes, then you have to, okay, 3 more minutes, then you have to build their trust that you will be there for them the next 10 to 20 years and that you won't change your policy in 1 year. And when you have the changes because circumstances change, like for instance the introduction of CO2 emission trading changed a lot, then you sit together and say, well, what does this change mean for us? What does it mean for the goals that we have? And how are we going to deal with it? So building the trust, setting long-term goals, working together are, I think, the most important factors for a successful environmental policy. Thank you.
I would just like to open it by one question, and then I'm going to open it to the floor. We're going to be talking about how states can be more autonomous, move forward, and make changes, even though there is, at least in this country, a vacuum of leadership on these issues in Washington, D.C. You are the Holland, or the Netherlands, is part of the European Union, and today was voting on whether or not to to accept the European Union Constitution. I actually don't know the results of that. I would assume you do. If you could tell us what happened and what does that mean about your sovereignty and your ability to be one of the leaders on environment and health in the European Union.
Okay. Well, we don't
maybe,
have
if
the
I could ask you, could you come up here and answer these questions? That would be great.
Well, I don't have the final results yet, but the exit polls showed that 62% voted no. So, and there was about a 65% turnout of voters. So I think it's most likely that we have voted no. And just like France a couple of days ago. And they're saying that the no in France stimulated more people in the Netherlands to vote no also. So it probably influenced it a little bit. What does the no mean for environmental policy? I'm not sure that it will have a lot of effect because the new EU law didn't have that many detailed suggestions on environment. I think the positive thing of the new law was the decision-making was more easy in a new situation, because a lot of countries now have a vote, and when they say no, then the whole thing doesn't go through. And in a new situation, you have more consensus. So 55% of the countries with 65% of the people within the EU are for a certain law, then it will pass. And in the past, it was, for instance, for industry, Italy is always opposite anything to do with industry. So they could block a lot of progressive measures that we wanted to take, for instance, on appliances and energy efficiency norms for appliances. They have been blocking the progression of these norms for the last 10 years. So, and in the future, they wouldn't be able to do that so much. If the other countries would agree on it, we would be able to move forward. So that was, I think, a plus of this new legislation. But at this moment, we don't know how we're going to continue, because the expectation is now that some other countries are also going to say no, so that we have to go back to the drawing table and make a new law or make some adjustments. Or so it will probably take some time again. And I think that's a shame, but well, it's something we can't do anything about.
So if you stay here, and I believe we have a few moments for questions. Anyone have a question here? And I believe that it is a microphone. Is there a microphone for the person who's asking a question? Okay, so you just have to speak up. And if you could stand up and speak up a little bit. Unfortunately, we're getting noise pollution from the hybrid bus.
Yeah, very interesting to hear your rendering program. What I was wondering is that there are sort of a lot of transnational companies that operate both the United States and both around the world. And I'm curious if they are abiding by the relevant regulations. Are you finding that there are dueling standards within the same companies and how they operate elsewhere around the world, or are they trying to implement those throughout?
Yes, I think there are different standards in different countries, especially if you compare the United States to Europe. I think there are some big differences. What we see is that in the beginning, when we started with the voluntary agreements, there was a lot of opposition within mainly the international-based companies against this, because they were saying, well, why should we participate in this, and we're international, and, well, only Holland is doing this. And it took a lot of work, especially from the sector organizations, to get these companies involved. And because it's a voluntary agreement, you don't have to participate if you don't want to. So we took a lot of effort to show them the advantages. And what we're seeing now, because we have now 15 years of experiences, for instance, with the agreements on energy, is that the companies use the Dutch company as an example within the other companies, and they're starting to monitor, for instance, energy efficiency in their other factories all over the world, and saying, well, I can be this efficient in the Netherlands, why can't I be that efficient in India or in the US or wherever? And they're implementing the measures that they're learning in the Netherlands, implementing them in their other factories. And of course, there's a time lapse between that, 5 to 10 years. But you see that this technology improvement gets gradually to the other factories also. So you have a bigger effect than just in the Netherlands. And I think that's one of the positive effects of this. And of course, we have some legislation that goes further than legislation in other countries, but within the EU we're trying to harmonize most of this legislation. And as the Netherlands, we said we don't want to be the front runners anymore, only in policy making, so pushing that new legislation will have higher norms. But once the norms are set, we're not adding on anything extra anymore, because already our industry is top of the world, so we don't have to do that much anymore.
Yeah.
In the end, I think the best incentive that we have is that they save a lot of money. If you use less energy, especially with the high energy prices that we have in Europe, you have less costs, and that's the biggest advantage that we can show them. And of course, being part of an agreement means that you have more sharing of knowledge, you have easier access to new technologies, and you can discuss new technologies with others, you can do a pilot with a couple of industries together. So it's easier to implement new technologies and to be aware of new technologies. That's also one of the advantages, I think.
I think what we're going to do is keep moving forward. If we have more questions at the end, that's what we're hoping to be able to do. Even if we have a glass of wine in our hand, we can ask the questions then. I think it's very refreshing and wonderful to be able to hear someone from the Ministry of Economic Affairs talking about trust and all these other issues and moving this forward. That's great inspiration to us. So continuing with that, someone from another land coming here to talk with us. I want to introduce Jaime Lerner from Cort Chiba, which I understand means land of many pine trees, something like that. No, excuse me.
Yes. Lots of pine trees.
And then we'll be hearing after that from Jerry Brown from the land of many oak trees. So I think that's a nice connection. Jaime Lerner is known as the father of green cities. A native of Curitiba, Paraná, Brazil. He created the Institute of Urban Planning and Research of Curitiba and participated in the preparation of a master plan for Curitiba that resulted in its physical, economic, and cultural transformation. He was mayor of the city for three terms, basically from 1971 to 1992. I could give you a long list of the things that he did as mayor of that city, and I think we can probably get into that, and he's going to show us a few things. Is that right?
Yes.
So I won't list all of those kinds of things. Many people know about the busways system, but I remember having been there that the most important thing was the civic participation and the compassion they showed for absolutely everybody in that city. It's so remarkable. So I think without further ado, I'm going to introduce you. And lastly, just mention, someone had told me that Jaime Lerner was the 1990 recipient of the UNEP Environmental Award. So we're very pleased to have you again at another UN event.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure and honor to share with so distinguished connoisseurs and their work. But I would like to come back always to my favorite subject, which are the cities. I'm sorry, sometimes in the mornings my English is terrible. In the afternoons it's worse. But I'll try to communicate anyway. I would like to give just, and this, I'm working for almost 40 years with cities, being a mayor, a former mayor, being a governor in a state of 399 cities, or being in many countries. Always I heard that a kind of tragedy syndrome. No, our city has no solution. Mayors from big cities, they're trying to say, our city is so big, 10 million people, there's no way, very difficult. And very, very pessimistic approach. First of all, I would like to say, if you project the tragedy, you'll have the tragedy. If you invest your energy to change trends that they are not desirable, you can make it. So that's a small example I would like to give. There's a saying from Tolstoy, if you want to be universal, sing your village. So let's sing my village. First of all, I have, after 40 years working with cities, I'm sure that every city in the world can make important changes in less than 2 years. No matter the scale of the cities, no matter are the financial resources. There is no excuse. Oh, our city has 10 million people. No excuse. No excuse. Always I say, our country is so poor, we cannot solve these problems. Our cities are big problems. A city is not a problem. The cities are solutions for a country. If we have a generous view regarding the cities. Because the city is the last refuge of solidarity. I remember the start of the discussion, globalization and solidarity. There was a kind of Manichaeism trying to say, trying on both sides. I remember a saying from the former president of Portugal, Mário Soares. He said a wonderful word. He said, we have to globalize solidarity. So what is the best way how to globalize solidarity? Through the cities. If you have good cities, you have good solidarity. People are living in the cities. In every country, every city, I realize that when you separate economy from human settlements, you have the disaster. So a city is a structure of living and working together. A state is a structure of living and working together. A country is a structure. You cannot have economy without people. Even a coin has two faces. One is the value, the other has a human face. So we started with the city. The city, many cities in the world, they teach us in many how the people they can behave, how you can make an important change, how it is possible. I realized one thing. I worked in between my terms as a mayor. I work as a consultant in many countries, many cities. In between my term as a mayor, as a governor, I work for in many countries, many cities. And I realize that there are a few conditions to make it happen. One, you have to have really a political will. I've met many mayors, governors all over the world. Yes, they have the political will. The second issue is solidarity. But not solidarity in the rhetoric. It's trying to understand the people's problems through their way, try to understand their to put yourself in their side. Solidarity is when you have people inside of you, not when you play once against the other, when you manipulate once against the others. The third issue is strategy. Because I've met many mayors, great political will, very solidarity mayors, but no strategy. What is a good strategy? I would say very simple. A daily balance between needs and potentials. So, if you're just working with the needs, you won't change anything. On the other hand, if you try to work only with the potentials, let's say the problem of the large number of people, you'll be far from people. So you have to keep this balance always. I remember my second term as a mayor. I came back from Berkeley, where I spent some time as a visiting professor. And that time, well, there was the grassroots movements. And I came back to my, and as a mayor, and every night I went to a different neighborhood to just to have their feeling. Every night a different, and always the needs, they were growing. And suddenly I say, I'm coming. Every night, I'm spending, every time, we're not going to change anything. So we decided to separate and work in the mornings with what could change, the potentialities, and the afternoons with the needs. I think this daily balance is a good strategy. But the fourth dimension is the most difficult. It's trying to build an equation of co-responsibility. That was said in your speech. You have to have all the people co-responsible with their co-responsibility. If not, it's you have to propose a scenario that everyone would understand it is desirable. And they will help you to make it happen. And you have to share with politicians, industrial managers, teachers. You have to share this. If you don't communicate the idea, if you don't give them the responsibility, there is no change. Okay, let's go very fast. Mobility. I heard one of the big problems we have in the world is mobility. And there's a lot of discussions which is the best system, or subways. When I started, it was in our cities. Every city that one, it's 1 million people, you have to have a subway. We try to have our own system of mobility. So we didn't have the money, we didn't have the conditions. We tried to build a good equation of co-responsibility. Let's go very fast. Every city has to have a design. I'm in the discussion, I'll come later. You have to have a design. Because if no, there is no design, no structure of growth, there is no priority. If it's any kind of structure, you have to deal now to enhance this structure, if it's linear, if it's radial, with public transport and land use, and we'll see how it worked. This is this, we didn't have money to invest in expropriation, that we took existing streets. This is the design of Curitiba. Well, where we have more, where we plant public transport, we have more density. So you can choose to live close and a system that can provide you 1 minute headway. You don't have to wait more than 1 minute, and sometimes 30 seconds. And so we took existing streets and we started with a system. Buses running in dedicated lanes. And we started with 25,000 passengers a day. Now we are transporting 2 million passengers a day. And no subsidies. It's one of the few systems in the world that there is no subsidy. And this is a complete network. Let's go. This is the fleet. The equation of co-responsibility was we designed the system, we invested in the itinerary, private companies, they bought some rural material, and we paid them by kilometer. That keeps the balance. And it works with, you know, how tough are the owners of public transport. And we made this change, we have a very easy system that works. You're boarding at the same level. This boarding cube transforms the bus, gives to the bus the same performance or a better performance than the subway. Okay. Even cities that they have subways, they'll need good surface. And these are the, just to give you an idea, again, boarding on the same level, very high quality elevators for the handicapped, and they're using the system normally. This is a double articulated bus, 300 passengers. Technically, it's written 270, but it's Sweden passengers, 300 Brazilians. So, let's give you an idea. The city of New York is planning to build the Second Avenue line of the subway. They are being discussing for 50 years. And they'll start this year, 2005, and probably they'll finish it in 2021. That means 70 years to build one line of a subway that will cost almost $4 billion and that will not transport more passengers than the bus that passes along our house. That means when we started, we didn't have all the answers. When we started, we understand we cannot sacrifice generation and generation for waiting for one line or two lines or three lines of a subway. And it took 25 years until another city made the same line, Curitiba, which was Bogota, and they're doing well. And now, 83 cities in the world, including Seoul, Korea, they are building systems of transport, surface systems. I'm not against subways. Everything is good for mobility. The idea that we are searching now is an idea that you can use all the systems with one condition. Don't compete in the same space. That means if you want a door-to-door service, you can have it. the taxi will take you to the closest station of the public service. Why? He would do it. Because he would be a partner of the system. If you want to go by car as close as possible to downtown area, you can do it. But you can leave it and take a van and go to the... It's, everything is possible. It has one thing. You cannot compete. And we're waiting to have a city that will like to implement this idea of mobility. The second issue is, and I'm finishing, I know I have, you know, during all my my time as a consultant, I worked a few weeks in Havana, Cuba. And you know, there are people, the leader, the generalissime jefe, they are used to speak about 11 hours, 14 hours. Sometimes I have this Cuban spirit. Mostly when I'm happy. And today I'm happy. So, allow me just to speak about environment. First of all, what is sustainability? There's a lot of definitions. You can be sustainable. What is, for me, is a very simple equation. You have to save more than you waste in everything. Save more than you waste. Sometimes I've met people searching all kind of materials, for instance, glasses, that they are more sustainable. But the most important issue on sustainability is the waste of energy that you're losing in the city. Living here, working here, having leisure here. This is a waste of energy and waste of your own energy. So sometimes we think that, oh, there's the problem of the ozone layer for earth warming and there's nothing to do. And we feel like terminal patients. We're terminal. There's nothing. There's a lot of things you can do immediately. First, use less your car. I would say I'm nothing against a car. A car is like our mother-in-law. You have to have good relationship with her. But you cannot leave, she'll conduct your life. So all the decisions in the city cannot be done through the car. Because a city, when it's based on the car, there's no feasibility. So, use less your car, separate your garbage. Every child in our city, you know how we did? We started teaching children in the schools to separate their garbage during 6 months. And the children, they teach their parents. And we have now the highest rate of separation garbage in the world, 70%. Sometimes it drops to 60%. Because the children, they know why it's important. It's important for energy, and the waste is one of the most important sources of energy. So the third issue is live close to your work. Adapt biodiversity. Integrate formal and informal. Transform damage in good solutions. Teach the children in everything. If you, everything has to be communicated to the people. They have to understand what is their part, what is their role in this issue. So that's why now the city of Curitiba has done a lot in the environmental issue. Not only separating garbage, not only changing our rates of green areas from a half square meter to 52 square meters per inhabitant, and the population tripled. But it's a whole, in the state also, it's a whole vision, for instance, not having, sometimes you think, it's from every agriculture, they have to keep the land not for environmental. So, and we understood very clearly that this we're trying to build clusters. And clusters are not good for biodiversity. So we asked them to provide the land close to the valley of the, our more important river, 1,300 kilometers. And it's there we have biodiversity, because we have this along this corridor all the conditions to have biodiversity. Well, just to finish in, my participation in this moment is one thing. Don't say it's not possible. Because when you say this, it's not possible. So the city can improve the quality of transport, housing programs. A city can solve better education problems. A city can help better healthcare, the care of children. You remember when we had in Brazil killing of street children? It was a very sad moment. And I would say, if every city could take care of its children, we didn't have this problem. Now, a state, I used a very good way of explicit nepotism. I invited my wife to work in the children project. She's here, Fanny. And she helped me. Can you imagine working with all the municipalities, all the mayors, all the teams? We could took off the streets 80,000 street children. We put them in the schools. And there are, in every city there are daycare centers, 500 daycare centers just we built recently. And I would say the only thing is every problem in a city, in a state, in a country, every problem has its own equation of co-responsibility. Recently, in the last elections for president, one of the candidates asked me to prepare for him an idea about the cities, how to deal with the cities, the problem of cities in Brazil. Can you imagine 5,000 municipalities, 160 million people? Everyone could say, no, it's not possible. When we started to understand, and just I would like to finish this. She's telling me. Be smart, speak. But I cannot. I can't. I have to tell you. When we realize How? So we have 200 municipalities, just 200 municipalities with less than 200,000 people. Just 70 with less than 500. So when we start to understand, yes, we have a big problem in seven big metropolitan areas. How we can solve this? What is the cost? And to finish, we realized that the cost to improving the quality of life in every city in the country, the cost is this, comparing what we lose in the daily casino of the financial speculation. That means, no, we don't, it's the economy. No, it's okay with the economy, it's okay, but try, don't postpone the investment on quality of life, because it's nothing comparing when you lose in every moment of the economy. So you won't change the economy if you won't change the economy of your country if you're trying to help people to have their life better. So do it. And the economy, it's not a big change. It's not a big investment. Well, I hope we'll discuss later on. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, I think we have time for a couple of questions, and then again, we'll open it at the floor at the end. So if somebody has a nice short question, a couple of people, anyone?
Right here. How long did it take you to implement the rail system once you designed it to be having that line?
Well, one line, you can do it now in less than 2 years. Why? Because we have now technology. We have bodybuilders, we have the technology for boarding, for everything. So it was hard to start. It was hard to tell people. I'm coming to a city and saying big public works doesn't help. And you know, here in San Francisco, when the freeway was gone, traffic is becoming better, much better. So big public works, they can transport faster one car from a jam place to another jam place. So it was hard in the beginning, but now we have technology to do it in 1 year, 1.5 year.
Anyone? Could you stand up, please?
Okay. Well, you know, it's hard to achieve an individual dream, because according differences between needs for or ambitions. And can you imagine how difficult it is to achieve a collective dream? Once during a lecture at the MIT, I was asked, well, I like what you said, but how to make it happen? I looked to the audience. There were people from Peru, Iran, Jamaica. How can I say? Different people from different countries, different systems of governments. But we started to discuss, and during this discussion, we achieved one point. Very simple. If you want to make it happen, you have to propose a scenario, an idea, a project that everyone or the large majority, they understand it is desirable. It's a desirable design. When they will understand this, they would help you to make it happen. So that deals with communication. I think one of the most difficult issues I realize in the political scenario is it's hard. There is no a very clear scenario in the political discussions. What is the scenario that you propose? Okay, in that city, in that country, in that. Because intentions, rhetorics, it depends the ability how to communicate. But the legitimacy to propose a scenario, and the people, they are being a little bit tired of campaigns, the kind of campaigns, I am the good one, the other one is the bad one. I think good communication, clever communication, to make people co-responsible helps to make a collective dream.
Sorry, my voice seems to like bounce off the speaker here. I think the inspiration of the last two speakers is equally matched by our next speaker. Now, this is a person who we all know as he's been a maverick for a really long time. And I know that he has some people who think he's a really good mayor of Oakland, and some people who have some really big problems with him. So he must be doing something right. I'm going to give you a little bit about his bio. So 1970, Jerry Brown was elected California's Secretary of State, and 4 years later, he became the governor, serving two terms. As governor, he increased jobs dramatically while establishing the first agriculture labor relations law in the country. He started the California Conservation Corps, enacted the California Coastal Protection Act, and implemented the country's first energy efficiency standards, making California the leader in solar and alternative energy. I think I'm tripping over it because it is such a shame, the things that happened in this state, and it is no more. Or we're crawling back. He brought more minorities into high government positions than any other prior chief executive. He had a radio program that ran from 94 to 97 called We the People, and he began his campaign for mayor in Oakland at that time, running on a platform of crime reduction, education, downtown revitalization. It's all the things that Jaime Lerner is talking about. Suddenly, Governor Brown had to start to take on in the city. He has won a second term as mayor of Oakland, and as you probably all know, he's recently declared his candidacy for the state attorney general. Mayor Brown.
Thank you. Now, how are we doing for time? Are we, where are we? I'd just like to get a little framework here. What time is it now? And what time?
About 15 minutes.
15 minutes. You've already heard all the wisdom. I heard that word maverick. I have to respond to that. I was talking to someone who I can't remember, but recently, and I said, I've now got a new theme. I'm going to become the champion of the status quo. And this person said, boy, that sounds good. I was being ironic. So I want you to distinguish my ironical statements from my hortatory statements. Sometimes I'm encouraging you to do things Other times I'm making fun of the way things are going or not going. So you can't be a maverick and champion the status quo at the same time. But if you're only a maverick, you're never going to get elected, except to very minor offices. If you're only a champion of the status quo, you shouldn't be elected to anything, because there's nothing you're going to add. So anyway, I've been listening to these things. I'm getting one thought here, if I got this right. Each transit mode should have its own lane. Okay, I'm taking that back to Oakland. I'm going to see if we can't find a street for buses and a street for cars. Then we had another street, we'd have it for bicycles. Then we'd have a really good city. But I'm going to ask you to come over and see if we can't figure that out, or at least a piece of that, because that sounds like a pretty good idea to me. Anyway, the difficulty that we have is that when we talk about planning, collective dreaming, goal setting, all that kind of good stuff, when you say, like, we, who's we here? Is it George Bush? Is it the Congress? Is it the state? Is it the city? You know, there's nodes of power and communication. And there's thousands of these nodes in this vast information system in which we're embedded. So it's very hard for one of the nodes, or 10 of them, or 20%, to dictate everything, even when you're the governor or you're the mayor. I introduced a lot of ideas. Actually, most of them weren't my ideas. I got them from somebody else, which is what we all do. We always get ideas from other people because we're social beings. They don't just come out of an isolated, atomized individual, but ideas are socially derived for the most part. Anyway, I brought Huey Johnson into the administration. And Huey can be a difficult individual to deal with sometimes. He can be somewhat confrontational. Anyway, he had a dream to protect 5 wild rivers in Northern California. In order to do that, an environmental impact statement under federal law had to be prepared. It comes and it goes. I'm radiating a certain amount of energy here, and it's interfering with the amplification. Okay, that's okay. Anyway, when Huey Johnson, who was my Secretary of Resources when I was governor, did not have any fixed legislative appropriation to prepare this environmental impact statement, he just grabbed the money from other pockets within his department. It's about $300,000. We got the environmental impact statement done. We took it back to Washington, and on the day before Reagan was sworn in 1980, this document was filed protecting the 5 Northern California rivers under the federal Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. Okay, for that act of impertinence, namely spending money that wasn't precisely designated environmental impact report for wild rivers, both houses of the legislature wrote me a letter demanding that I fire Huey Johnson because he protected 5 wild rivers without permission. So that, it's an indication that, you know, it's a problem to get these collective dreams implemented, because often the dream is way out ahead of where the status quo happens to reside. And so you do need some courage, and you have to be willing to be somewhat insensitive to the status quo and its custodians. That's where I refer to my adversaries as the custodians of the status quo. And they want to protect what is. And by the way, protecting what is very important, because if we changed everything all the time, we'd go crazy. So you do need continuity. But when the continuity is taking us over a cliff, then you have to disrupt the continuity in order to shift it. Now, how can you do that? Can you elect somebody? Not likely. Can you get the corporate America all of a sudden to be converted to a non-corporate perspective? Probably not. But people do rise up. In the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, and before Martin Luther King, people in cities in the South began to assert their rights. And that, in fact, they weren't even rights then. They became rights as they were recognized in the court. When Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring in the early 1960s, this had a power. And then different women that articulated a perspective supporting women's perspectives and what became rights. So there's always the sensitive, articulate individual or group of sensitive, articulate individuals and eloquent that can begin to feed into this system ideas that are not currently acceptable. So we live in a world where it isn't just about somebody planning at the top where we're going. We live in the world of somewhat laissez-faire, individual units, business, individuals, whatever, doing what they want to do to make a profit. And it's very hard to all of a sudden organize and say, well, we're going to limit fuel expenditures, or we're going to limit carbon emissions, or whatever the case may be. It runs up against this freedom. Now, freedom is pretty powerful. We have a president who purports to be bringing freedom over there in Iraq by shooting people. And he really is convinced that if he shoots enough people, they're going to be free over there. That may turn out to be, I don't know, I'm not even making the point on that. But the idea that I want to emphasize is that freedom is very powerful. And when you say, we want to limit your freedom to sprawl, to emit CO2, to throw all manner of chemicals into the stream of commerce, you're running up against this powerful desire in the modern economy. This morning I was reading a favorite text that was given to me by Ivan Illich, who was one of the founders of the environmental movement. And he assigned me this book in 1983 in Cuernavaca, and I'm still trying to plumb its depths. It's called From Mandeville to Marx. And good, you just tell me. I'll stand back, and you just raise your hand if it's too loud or too fuzzy or too quiet. Anyway, in this book, From Mandeville to Marx, it traces the emergence of the idea of the economy and its parallel idea, the autonomous individual. And this man, Mandeville, had a fable, the fable of the bees. And in this fable, he said, vice, or what everyone thought was vice for the last several millennia, is really virtue. Greed is what makes society develop. And he was the first one to express this rather radical idea in the early 1700s. And then Adam Smith picked it up, and then we are where we are today. Underneath it all is this notion that vice is virtue in terms of economic growth and development. That's a deeply embedded intellectual construct. So, now, you want to kind of turn that and say, well, now with nuclear weapons, nuclear power plants, genetic engineering, all manner of 80,000 chemicals, very few of which have been tested, we've got a lot of tools that when we start using them, it has a big impact. So greed plus technology plus unlimited desires really creates a dangerous situation. And the environmental movement, well, has to resist that. And it's not going to just come from the conventional. It's going to come from people outside being able to sense what it is we're doing and where we're headed, and being able to communicate that message through gatherings like this, through writings, through efforts at working with political figures. Now, in different cities, since there's so many cities, there's more chance to find a mayor or city council people who would like to embark upon a more enlightened, sustainable path. So that's why I believe the cities are so important. And while the overall trajectory looks ominous, Gregory Bateson used to call it all the lemmings just kind of headed over the cliff or something. I don't know what lemmings do, but they don't survive, at least in the story. So, you know, we are faced with this problem that there's no principle of satiety. I want to at least leave you something to remember. No principle of enoughness. You can never get enough by the terms of vice is really virtue. So if we have this unlimited set of desires, and if we believe that vice is really virtue, and if we add to it technological change, accelerating, added to population growth, we have a big problem. So we got to turn some of that around, and so that's the job, and that's the task of where we are. It's so large that we got to pick at it, and I think the most important thing is to do wherever you can make an impact, whether it's a bus line, whether it's a recycling program, whether it's reducing pesticides on food, whether it's getting people to live closer together. All of those things are good, but it's only in a context of very articulate communication of our dilemma and the possibilities for a more sustainable life. It's that continuous articulation by artists, by academics, by enlightened corporate leaders, politicians, whatever. But the thing that's really going to turn it are those little catastrophes that wake us up. Those little heart attacks that get you to stop smoking. The little problems that shake us up. When you get a disaster like a tsunami, we get our solidarity. But just ordinary, slow destruction doesn't engage our generous impulses. So I would say, having worked in the field of the political, we inside government and inside the political realm need you, need the activists, need the artists that can vision something that isn't. And with enough luck and enough people inspired and enough organization, we turn things, if we have any luck. Part of this is going to be luck, I have to say. So I do think we're challenged. We're extremely challenged. I look at just the idea of fuel efficiency in cars. The last person to increase fuel efficiency was George Bush Sr. So that was because when we had our Democratic president, who looks very good compared to the second Bush, we had the mantra, it's the economy, stupid. I'm still waiting for someone to be elected who says, it's the environment, stupid, because the economy is a subset of the ecology. In fact, I like to say that, eco-logos. Okay, eco means house. Logos, in the Christian tradition, is God. So it's a little higher. Economy, eco-nomos, nomos are rules. So nomos is subordinate to logos, if you want a little bit of theology here, if not etymology. So I'm giving you theology, etymology, ecology, all of that together. And that's what we have to emphasize, that you don't fight nature. Not with junk science and not with junk politicians. Nature has its own rules, and we have to get on board with nature. Nature is not getting on board with us. And that's the real message that has to be communicated. So I think I ought to stop there, but see, I got my biggest applause when I said I was going to stop. I really appreciate that.
briefly, I do need some of that energy. Can you just say briefly, having gone from being the governor of the state to the mayor of the city, how you were able to get things through in one way versus another? I mean, as a governor, you can bring on the other Mavericks to do the things like Huey Johnson and Don Turner and other people like that. In the city, who are your allies and who are your Mavericks to make things happen in Oakland, in any city?
Well, I think everything works on what do they say when, you know, that you always react. I think we are reactors rather than actors, so that one administration can react from the previous one and try something different. So in Oakland, there was years, decades of non-development in the downtown. There was a lot of blighted land. It was there when I was governor. And there were so many efforts to try to bring people, bring shopping, retail, whatever. It just didn't happen. There's a recession, there's an earthquake. I mean, there's a lot of things happen. So a certain amount of potential was built up. And so I came in, and it just was, I think, the right time. Timing is very critical. Kairos, that's the meaning critical or opportunity. You have to have the opportunity. If there's not the opportunity, then, you know, you're pushing against it. So I had a vision. Because I started the urban strategy in 1978 as governor. And, of course, then it's just rhetoric. Governors are essentially pontificators. They don't do anything, really. I mean, they can do some damage here and some damage there by whom they appoint or veto or whatever. But things get done at cities, in localities, at addresses. So when I talked about urban strategy, that's just general set of statements and some rules and laws we were talking about. Now you get down to a city and you can affect a boulevard. You can go from one way to two way, or you can attract people to live. And in fact, I've done that. I built the first building in Jack London Square in decades, and now there's four under construction, and there's already been three or four built since then. I live in the former hardware department section of Sears Roebuck. But there are no more wrenches because it's now a loft. But people, it's being re-inhabited. In fact, that was a statement we used to talk about back when we had all those flaky people in Sacramento. We talked about re-inhabitation. And I kept thinking about that. We're going to re-inhabit Sears Roebuck. And that's what you have to do. In the city, to answer your question, you actually do things. It's hands-on. You see people. It's specific. It's this street corner. As you move up the abstraction ladder, you're talking about the environment, crime, education. That's different than the garbage at 27th and Telegraph, the loft at 2nd and Harrison. Those are very specific. Or the murder that happened 2 days ago behind my loft of Vincent, a homeless guy who I'd had so many conversations with. So it's concrete. It's more, the scale is doable, and citizens can come in and have their way. They can really be heard. So there's less power in the global sense, but there's more power in the functional sense that you can actually see things being done. So run for mayor. It's a great experience.
If we have one question, Or we'll move on. What do you think? Okay. Can you stand up, Susan?
Previous speakers, Mayor Brown, there was a sense that this is harder to do in the U.S. Are we just uniquely contentious or uniquely rapacious here in the West, where it's possible to consider doing these things in cities like Curitiba or in countries like the Netherlands, but here it's that much harder? Is that what we have going here?
Well, I think it's very fragmented, very pluralistic, very diverse in every sense of the word. In other words, who's in charge? I'd have to say the economy's in charge. And then you can go back and think about Mandeville, how the economy works. So it's difficult. We don't have, I don't know, I don't want to get into trouble here and define our, the way things work. But it's if you look at the politics is about getting the money to take the polls, to put on the TV ads, to tell you what you want to hear, to get elected, so you can raise the money to take the polls, to put on the TV ads, so you can get reelected, until they term limit you out and you run for another office. That's kind of where we are. It's pretty superficial and erotic. I don't know. I wouldn't say other countries are that much better. We have a lot of space here, and you have some very powerful private sector movements. But I think the power has to come out from outside. It's going to come from activist groups. It's not going to come from inside. They're just in the way it is. The inside is to be activated by the outside, which has to be you. And your eloquence, your organization, your persistence, and your ability to seize the moment when something bad happens. For example, when I was governor of California, 50 men were found to be sterile because it happened that none of their wives had any babies for 5 years. They said, what is this all about? And they were working in a plant manufacturing DBCP. So we banned it. And at that moment, I turned to my Division of Industrial Relations and said, gee, how does this work? Why couldn't we abandon it? And he said, we had rat studies for 30 years. And Don Boyle, my Director of Industrial Relations, said, Governor, you can't ban anything unless you have dead bodies. So you might think about that. I hope that isn't completely true, but that's what the man said. It's very hard to ban a dangerous substance without dead human bodies. So, is that an up or a down? I mean, I'm trying to give you a report from the front. You make of it what you can.
Sorry, Rachel. Thank you, Mayor Brown. That note that he left is a downer, but
it's an upper.
But it is an upper because just in the Los Angeles Times yesterday, there was an article saying that California may lead the rest of the country on banning chemicals. There's a number of them being introduced, and I believe that there was one that you're going to be talking about William Chan's, but others that are even saying that we need to bring our list of chemicals that need to be banned up to the list, the same list that the Netherlands has. So California is paying attention. California can be a leader once again. And we have some with us today who has also worked many, many years in California and works with Assemblywoman Wilma Chan. And Rachel Richman has been involved in public service and policy for 25 years, helping to craft landmark environmental health legislation for the state of California. She currently serves as chief of staff for Wilma Chan in the 16th district, and she's the chair, Wilma is the chair, of the State Assembly Committee on Health. So Wilma is a real champion for this. And the reason that we asked Rachel to come in last is to sort of bring us back, bring us back to the current reality on chemicals policy in California and the country, but certainly what's going on here, where it is single issue, one chemical at a time, changing. That's not how we're going to win. It's the things that are happening in Holland, in Curitiba, in Brazil, was happening in California, and we had a model for that, and is happening in Oakland and other cities. If we look at chemicals policy, not just as the chemicals, but as the inherent problem of dealing with the system, and how do we fundamentally change that? So, Rachel?
Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking the leadership of the WELL Network for bringing us all together today in a really interesting forum. one of Wilma Chan's constituents is Mayor Brown, and I have to tell you, it's an extraordinary experience to sit down with someone who has no limits about what's possible to brainstorm legislation. What I'm going to do today is talk briefly about the journey we've gone through to take a broader approach around chemical policy, what we need to do to make a safer environment in the next 25 years, and the role of women in making that happen. Wilma Chan is primarily interested in children's health and education. But over time, what we began to see was that there was a connection between environmental toxins, a child's health status, and how well they did in school. And so we thought, you know, we need to take a look at this. The problem is we didn't know anything about it. We have no scientists on staff. So we met with a number of people, some of whom are in this room, who helped us to learn about it and continue to help us to learn about the issue. And in 2002, we decided we needed to educate the entire legislature and break down these silos between health policy and environmental policy. So we held the first state hearing ever looking at the relationship between environmental health and how well children do in school. And we expected, you know, people would come. What we didn't expect was that a who's who of the Capitol in Sacramento would show up, and it would be a packed house. We knew at that point that we were onto something, and that the time had come for an environmental health legislative agenda. In doing so, we faced a number of serious obstacles, lack of information by legislators, a largely unorganized constituency, lack of scientific studies, and very strong industry opposition. And the way that we have tried to deal with this and the other legislators carrying bills is by teaming up with think tanks and community organizations who can fill in the blanks, who can build the grassroots support, who can doctors, moms, who can come and speak at hearings and lobby. And to a large degree, it has worked. While I think having dead bodies is helpful in passing a bill, it's not necessary a great deal of the time. We started by with a bill to ban PBDE, which is a toxic fire retardant. And it, again, it was brought to us by people in the community, different organizations. We stayed persistent. We never gave up. We talked to our opponents. We made a couple of compromises. And California became the first state in the country to ban PBDEs. This year, we've taken on a much tougher task. We're working to ban toxic toys. We're working to ban phthalates, which it makes plastic soft, like teethers, and bisphenol A, which helps, it's used in like baby bottles. It helps plastic not just kind of shatter. And as with, And so our ban is on the use of phthalates and bisphenol A in any products for children under 3 years old because they're much more vulnerable. I mean, no mother would put a cigarette in their kid's mouth. Why would they ever put a teether that's full of phthalates in their kid's mouth? As with PBDE, we challenge the industry to bring us our studies, which we would weigh as we develop the legislation. Industry is very much opposed to this, but the PBDE ban showed us that it wasn't impossible and that we could succeed with the right combination of factors. So here's how we've approached this toxic toys ban. We asked allies to give us studies and background and to activate their activist networks, which they have done, and have provided us with experts to speak at hearings. Experts, by that I mean people who are mothers, doctors, scientists, or just involved in their community. And we've tried to engage the industry to give us the studies because that showed that there were no problems, that there were no health problems. They were reluctant at first. They eventually gave them to us because, frankly, our goal is we don't want to drive them out of business. We just want to keep kids safe. And we want to work with them to develop a different way of being. So they'll stay in business and prosper, and children won't bear the effects. We actually read all these studies. Wilma Chan read these scientific studies. And what we found was that in about 90% of the independently funded studies, they identified that there were health problems with these chemicals, while for the industry-funded studies, there were zero that found any health problems. And we determined that the danger outweighed the use of these chemicals and that they really have to go. Now, the industry at this point is still opposed. The bill passed its first committee. It's unclear exactly what lies ahead. We know we'll win eventually. But to give you a sense of what it's like in the Capitol, each chemical has their own lobbyist. Like a guy will come in and say, I'm the lobbyist for phthalates. Plus, all the chemical associations have lobbyists, and businesses that use these chemicals have lobbyists. There are probably a dozen lobbyists working against this bill and the ones like it that are pending in the legislature. And I got to tell you, they're very good. They videotape themselves when they testified in committee so they could improve their performance. When the facts didn't suffice, they lied to legislators about our bill, saying that there would not be allowed to be any canned goods in the United States if our bill became law. And it's not just our bill, but bills by other members, too. For example, Senator Carol Migden has a bill to require labeling of cosmetics that contain the chemical phthalates. And so what the industry did was, at the hearing on this bill, they brought a cake to the hearing, and they said, look at this, and all this food coloring and artificial additives and all that stuff. You know, it's full of chemicals. Why don't you, you know, you eat this, but yet you want this bill for cosmetics. Now, you know, it's always a stupid idea to take on Carol Migden. And she basically said to them that what the difference was that in making a decision to eat that cake that they brought in, we knew what was in it. So people could make a decision. The reason that all of this is such a tough fight is because we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. The bisphenol A industry is huge in this country. So when we saw what happened in Carol Migden's hearing and Judy Chu's hearing, she has another bill, we were fully loaded. We came with tons of support letters from people in the community and expert testimony, and we managed to get the bill through. We also, at the same time, began a public campaign going to farmers markets and giving away toxic-free phthalate toys. To say the least, we were mobbed. So, out of all these bills and looking at the other bills in the legislature, this is kind of the place that we've come to in taking a longer look, which is very hard in the legislature because a senator serves a maximum of 8 years, an assembly member a maximum of 6 years. I mean, that's about 5 minutes in legislative time. And so it's hard to think out, you know, 25 years. What we learned was that we can't do it chemical by chemical in most cases, that we have to have a broader approach. And we're already seeing some of those kinds of policies proposed in Sacramento. We have a bill that requires that companies give their testing methodologies to the state. This is a bill that will save the state millions of dollars in developing the testing methodologies by just asking the company to just lend it to us on a confidential basis so we can detect these chemicals. This bill is on the floor of the assembly. We hope it'll pass. The Republicans, unfortunately, are not only opposed, they are what's referred to in Sacramento as triple opposed. And there are other bills that are pending as well. When we look at how do we take that broader view, how do we take that longer view, like, say, 25 years down the line, things are going to be better. What are the components that we have to put in place? The first thing is we have to take a broader approach. We can't do, like, chemical and then this chemical and this chemical. We also need to do more ongoing work in the community among environmentalists, healthcare providers, doctors, women, activists, to build a demand for more safety and more change. There also needs to be a strategic plan for scientific studies to bolster our legislative efforts, because we've been very fortunate that we've had pretty good science to help us move our bills and to convince legislators. We also need to educate legislators, because if they're only there briefly and they don't already know the issues, we need to meet with them in their home offices. We need to do conferences and briefings when they're running for office, letters. All of these things really make a difference. I've heard some discussion about maybe a public-private commission, state commission, to help manage some of this. And I think that that's an interesting idea, because with term limits, we no longer have an institutional memory. And that's one of the most important things that a commission could do, in addition to bringing people together. We also need to remember to include the business community. I got a press release the other day that said our phthalates bill, this company in Tennessee has already implemented it. I mean, this bill hasn't even got to the floor of the assembly yet. But it shows us that we have many allies in the business community, and we have complaint calls from businesses who want to use safer materials, but the people who give them the chemicals won't tell them what's in it, which is really kind of amazing. We also need to engage in a more public, popular education campaign, because we know that if most people know about environmental health, they will agree with us. So whether it's a toy giveaway or we did this other thing where we pulled all the women's magazines, like Good Housekeeping and Self and More and so on and so on, to approach them about running articles. Because with all due respect, most people in California do not read the Utney Reader, as important a publication as that is, that we need to reach people where they are. These components are all part of a continuum, and change is not possible without us doing all of them. Particularly since in the coming years, I think we're going to see the major issue in California is going to be around air pollution. We already have an asthma epidemic. So the role of women, we're leading this campaign already. I mean, almost every environmental health bill is carried by a woman, and we're leading it as policymakers, moms, doctors, scientists, activists, and we need to do more. And we know that we'll succeed, because we know that when women see their family's health and environment threatened, they act. Thank you. And for any of you who would like to be kept abreast of goings-on or would like to work with us in developing legislation, let's swap business cards. Thank you.
Okay, I just have one question having to do with constituencies in being ready for this. In Europe, their recent opinion polls rank chemicals and radioactivity as the leading environmental issues. And that's shown that that's had an impact, so that they are now going forward with one of the most comprehensive, safer chemical policies ever known to man. They call it REACH. It has a long name that describes it, but it really is moving toward a much bigger fundamental change in policy, much more of the safer, better safe than sorry approach. As you looked out into that meeting with the legislators, and you said a lot of people came to hear what you had to say. When you look out into the public, into this audience, or to the people in your constituency, or your area, or Wilma Chan's constituency, what are you hearing? Why aren't people marching to Sacramento to get rid of these toys, to get rid of all of these chemicals, to move toward a REACH-like approach?
I think people feel a little isolated. The budget crisis has dominated the Sacramento agenda for many years. But we know that people have been marching. I mean, there were about 25,000 people in Sacramento last week. What I would propose here is we should sit down in another room and let's organize that march.
Are there questions for either Rachel or anyone else on the panel? Sarah? And then Sarah, and then you.
This is for Rachel. To the best of my knowledge, these phthalates are not produced in California. So to go to the individual chemical lobbyists actually have a lot of weight in the California legislature, or do we have more?
Yes. They do carry a lot of weight, and they're very skilled at what they do, and they bring a lot of heft. Because remember, it's not like you go to Safeway and buy a jar of bisphenol A to take home, but all the products that we take home have all this stuff in it. So clearly, there's a link. And they work very well in coalition. I think it's an important part of the discussion. But remember that California is its own country. And we know that whatever happens here will happen elsewhere. And so while I think, you know, it's part of the mix, it's not driving it. I mean, with all due respect, who's driving it? Are all these moms who just won't let go on this issue and who keep raising it and raising it and raising it. It is an issue. There is legislation pending, and if you see me afterwards, I can talk to you more about it.
Let me just repeat that because I'm not sure. Lauren speaks as softly as I do. How much public participation was there in advance of passing the National Environmental Policy Plan? Is that right?
I think there was a lot of public participation. I think the I think Peggy already mentioned that the dead seals were kind of the starting point of the discussion, and that was because the public was finally seeing what the chemicals in the water that they couldn't see were doing. So they started some actions, and then government took over. And I think NGOs and environmental organizations play a very important role in the Netherlands in developing new policies.
I'm wondering if there's some way that, you know, how the Netherlands might be able to influence what's going on in the United States. If you have any suggestions, are the European countries doing something to wake up this administration and wake up our country? Is there any way that this can happen? You can help us. We need help. Does everyone hear that?
Well, I think as Europe, we certainly do try to influence the United States. And I think the most obvious is the discussion around CO2 emission trading, where we would like other countries in the world to participate in the system, because the more countries participating, the better the system will work. And also in the post-Kyoto discussions, we will try to get the United States to this time really participate and hold up their end of the bargain. But it's really difficult to influence a country like the United States. I mean, it's so what we do a lot is try to show the good results that we're booking and try to show the economic effects of these results, because I think that's maybe something I didn't mention in my first presentation, because it's, for us, it's so obvious as the Ministry of Economic Affairs that economy is one of the key factors that you have to take into account. If you want changes, they have to be economically efficient also, or they will never be sustainable. And maybe as an example, the first round of agreements on energy efficiency in the first 10 years, we had 22.3% energy efficiency improvement, but we also had €700 million saving each year in industry because of their lower energy bills. So we try to share these examples and try to tell the United States that being environmental friendly will also mean being economically efficient. And we try to share technologies, and we have programs and projects where we work together. But it's difficult, and we're really willing to help, but it's maybe we should work more on a project basis and less on a political basis. So if you have any suggestions, you're more than welcome.
Mr. Leonard, I'm curious if you talk a little bit about the political conditions when you came into office and the role that played in making it harder or easier. Because Brazil was under education at the time, so could you talk a little bit about the effect that the political conditions in 1971 had on
Can you help?
Yes. What were he wanted to know what the political situation was in 1971 when you came in.
Okay. In my first term as a mayor, I was an appointed mayor. My second term, I was appointed mayor, but they are different times. My third term, I was an elected mayor, and as a governor, I was elected and re-elected. I would say, being an appointed mayor, it was during the military regime. What happened? The governors, they didn't want any kind of political shade, so they tried to appoint some technical people with some technical background, and and that was a whole generation of mayors that started their political career. Now they're in different parties, some of them good, some of them not so good, but that was the time that the choice was technically, and it was hard to being a mayor, an appointed mayor, because being appointed you can be fired next day. Everyone wanted the position of the mayor. So I had a very young staff. I was 33 years old, and at the same time I had a very young staff, and we knew that we had to make very fast, because probably next week it couldn't be. I had investigations every day, because we have communists in my office and everything, you know, that kind of stuff. And the only way we decided is having the support of people. And the only way to having the support of people is you have to make it very fast. So that was the most critical time, was my third term. I was a mayor elected, and every day I had riots in front of the city hall. That was normal. But I had support. I was an elected mayor. But I would say our team behaved in the same way. During the bad times and during less times. And because we realize when you have a very straight relationship with people and participation, I think politically being part is very important. Everyone that should be part of the problem is more important than just having a meeting and just say, oh, we'll have participation. Participation is a game when the leadership, someone has to start. If there is no start, there is no participation. So sometimes the leadership, political leadership, they start. Sometimes the NGOs or the community associations, they start, and it's back and forth, back and forth. That's the best way. So, but I would say politically, democracy is not consensus. It's a process of conflicts. And you have to know how to deal with it. You don't expect the whole consensus. So sometimes in some power, in some governments, people, they wait for the consensus, or as a meeting could bring all the solutions. You have to start with a proposal. Propose an idea. There's the answer. And I would say it's a commitment with imperfection.
That's a good way to end right there.
It's a commitment. That means you have to start. What was the secret of Curitiba? Simplicity, not wanting to have all the answers. And that's important when you want creativity. If you want all the answers, you'll never start. Okay. So, and leave the people to correct you, and this is a process that you can be corrected always.
Thank you. Susan, you have the last question.
Rachel, is given that the program is voluntary, in the Netherlands, does the government use its purchasing power to favor those industries that seem to be doing right thing. And Rachel, are you looking at in where the government in terms of your legislation, where does government funding say for hospitals to buy items to favor those alternative safe alternatives?
I'll go first. Well, because of the legislation that we have within the EU, it's not possible to favor a company. But what we do with public purchasing is that we set standards and say we want products that have these and these qualities and use these and these materials. And as long as there are two or more companies that can deliver those products, then you can set those standards. So that's the way that we try to do this. And in the Netherlands, we've just finished a program where we, for each product group, have renewed the standards that we ask to become even more sustainable in our own purchasing. And it's really working because, as a government, you are a really big buyer, so you have a big influence in the market. And you set an example.
You know, it's a wonderful idea, and it's a complicated issue to try and implement. Wilma Chan actually carried a bill that requires the Department of General Services, if given a choice between an environmentally safe product or safer product and a regular product, comparable prices, to go for the environmentally safer product. From what I understand, it's not really being implemented. And the reason, I think, is because, it's purchased by a purchasing department, and they're not environmental experts. So it's one thing to say to the purchasing department, only buy recycled paper. It's another thing to say, look at the construction of all these desks or all these other things that we buy and figure out which is safest and price comparable and buy that. So clearly, it's an idea that we need to do more work on.
Okay. Well, first I want to have a round of applause for all our speakers. Thanks. So just to round up, we will have, and I'm hoping that everybody sort of went back and got a glass of wine and some bread if you were hungry, but we will have a reception now until 5:30. I did want to mention two things. I mentioned really briefly that there is a three-day conference that the government of the Netherlands is hosting at the St. Francis. Is that right, the St. Francis?
The Fairmont Hotel.
Excuse me. Thank you. The Fairmont Hotel, June 2nd through the 4th. And it is called Developing a Sustainable Society, Learning from the Dutch Experience. If you are at all interested in in how the Netherlands was able to do this, the financial incentives, how they work with industry, how they're able to do it over time, I really encourage you to go to this. It is probably one of the best things that you could do this in the next few days, other than having come here. Thank you very much. The last I want to announce that Well Network has commissioned a white paper looking at taking all the information that Rachel and others have put together, what's coming out of Holland and in other places, and putting it together, but taking a look at chemicals policy and planning, and then how could California move forward with this, and not just New York, California, but looking at another state like California, like New York. Keep coming back to California. So we're looking at two states and how this can be approached. There is one other report that's coming out this fall that the legislature has commissioned and is coming out of the University of California at Berkeley, looking at California competitiveness and how can California be more competitive with the coming changes in chemical policy. So there is enormous amount of work coming forward in this state and in other states. We are filling the void of what's going on in Washington and in other places. I applaud the speakers today for being leaders in helping us and many, many other people understand this in the world, that we don't have to roll over and accept this, that we can make change. And I thank you all for being here today.